Hi, I'm Mike Sainsbury, and welcome to this ASI cast, where Brian Jacobs catches up with Rob Norman, for many years Chief Digital Officer at Group M. As becomes clear in the interview, Rob has been involved in the opportunities afforded by digital technology from the very first. And as an early adopter, Brian was interested to learn what his take was on the most notable changes over this time, and what these changes point to for the future. From dial-up to broadband, to mobile internet, and beyond.
Okay, well, hi everybody, this is Brian Jacobs, and this afternoon I'm joined by Rob Norman, who is known, I'm sure, to many of you listening. Rob is, or has for many years now, been Chief Digital Officer at Group M, based in New York. He's now an advisor to Group M and a board director to various other businesses as well. So hi there, Rob.
Hello, Brian.
Indeed. So, Rob, I remember a long, long time ago when I was at an agency and you were at, I think you were at MEC at the time, actually. CIA, was it? Might have been CIA, yeah. Probably was CIA. I remember you doing a presentation to a very august body of people at Nestle on the sort of coming changes in digital, in the digital world and digital media. And I remember thinking and saying to my team when we got back to the office, so how come we kind of didn't do that or can't do that or don't seem to know about any of that? So I was deeply impressed. And I think it was in 1998 that you did that. So you've been at this for quite a while. So what are your sort of memories of the biggest changes that you've seen over that period of time?
Well, clearly there's been a number of phases, and I got involved in interactive marketing at a time when you did one of two things. You either built CD-ROMs for people, which became kiosk installations at train stations or Legoland or somewhere like that, or you built very early web-based product that was accessible via a 14.4 or later a 28.8 modem. And so there was a phony war period, if you like, in which people began to realize the potential of the web, and which was just succeeding CompuServe and Prodigy and so forth, which were closed proprietary systems. And then the real business end of it started with the gathering distribution of broadband, and broadband in domestic environments as well as business environments. And the transition of no internet to dial-up internet was a much more minor event than the transition from the dial-up internet to the broadband internet, and probably a more minor event then than the broadband internet to the mobile internet. So we've seen it through a number of phases, if you like. And it's been interesting to observe sort of what's been different, what's remained the same. And I think the things that have remained the same is that you've always had to have a very strong sense of what you wanted to happen when the consumer, whether it was a business user or a, you know, a member of the public, got to wherever you wanted them to get to, what that event was worth to you and them, and therefore how much you needed to invest in the creation and distribution of whatever the what was in order to make economic sense of it. And those kinds of things have remained completely true. They remain true through the early days of the web. They remain true through the early days of the promotion of websites with banner advertising. They remain true of building Facebook pages and buying likes and so forth. And I think they remain true of commerce sites and so forth. So I think there's many things that really haven't changed.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a very interesting point, that, isn't it? Because I think we tend to sort of say, well, key kind of media principles stay much the same. But you're making a very interesting point that when it comes to what used to be called interactive, as you say, and now digital, I guess, even some of these key things haven't changed either.
Well, they don't. And I think that very often people have chased baubles a little bit too much and lost sight of some guiding principles of what they're trying to do in business. Now, there are people that would say that what I've just described is a kind of anti the philosophy of risk-taking innovation. But I've always believed that there were frameworks for innovation that absolutely embraced a degree of risk. And when one looked at innovation, the object, the exercise was to understand what kind of behavior you were trying to induce. Did that behavior represent something that was significantly different from a behavior that existed before? Did it enable people to do things better, faster, cheaper? And what were the opportunities and the gating factors to those kinds of things scaling? And I always had a sense that on the first part of this conversation, which was always have an eye on utility and value, and then on the second one, always have an idea on the likelihood of behavior change and the ability to scale, was really important. And I, you know, if I have proud moments in my career, I was utterly dismissive of Second Life when Second Life was all rage. And I was utterly dismissive of 3D television in a different kind of era. And the reason for the first was that the network effect required for Second Life to be meaningful was not going to be there because the distribution of broadband to the home was not meaningful when Second Life came into being, and it needed to be. And the distribution issue around 3D television was that I never believed that the sense of wonder could overcome the sense of nausea. And you know, I've been right about two things maybe in my life. Those could be it. I've been wrong about lots of others, but you know, there are certain things that you try and understand and stick to.
Do you think the Second Life would work if it was introduced now, as a matter of interest? Because obviously the distribution mechanisms are now there.
Well, interestingly, I think Second Life probably could have existed had it been introduced 3 years ago rather than now. And I think that in a funny sort of way, Second Life was almost a composite of the use cases of massively multiplayer online games plus Facebook, plus Snapchat. You could argue with the ingredients of Second Life. So it wasn't a single destination. I think now that most people's reaction to a Second Life type of environment would be heavily colored by their perception of the weaponization of social platforms that we've seen over the last 18 months or so, and the increasing sort of tale of revelation of wide-eyed optimism and bald-faced commercialism overcoming any sensible judgment about the potential causes of harm of certain parts of the system. And I think that something like Second Life would be immediately associated with that. It would be associated with dark web and so on and so forth. So I think it would be complicated.
Yeah. And it's interesting, isn't it, you make the point about 3D television. I mean, I've always thought that too often people come up with ideas just because they sort of can. You know, we can make this, so let's make it, as opposed to starting off with a consumer and working out what the demand is and then inventing something that satisfies that demand. And
so, but you know, then you take Steve Jobs' version of that, which is the consumer doesn't know what they want, which was the Henry Ford view of, you know, if you ask them, they want faster horses. And so I do think you need to do both. I think it depends on where you are in the value chain, Brian, and you and I have made our careers, if we may elevate our participation in the business to that level, out of by and large being the agents of other people and hopefully being people to whom other people ask advice as to where they should allocate their shareholders' money in the pursuit of a particular goal, which is enriching their relationships with consumers and building their sales and their margins. That's kind of almost all of the questions you and I ever got asked were, that was the end game. And so if those are the questions you're asked, then yes, having those, that very practical standpoint as a filter is really important. If on the other hand, you are an entrepreneur or an inventor, whether you're Travis Kalanick seeing an imperfection in a marketplace that created Uber, or if you're Johnny Ive and Steve Jobs reinventing the iPhone, or if you're Reed Hastings reinventing the on-demand entertainment business, then thank God for the risk takers and praise be.
You mentioned that you've got those are two things that you the two things you've mentioned were two things that you got sort of right. Were there any things that, looking back, that really kind of surprised you and you sort of never really thought they were going to work and then they sort of suddenly exploded and became massive successes?
actually, well, there's a good part of the story and a bad part of the story. So the good part of the story is, actually, no, not really. I didn't see much that turned out to be successful that when I first saw it, I kind of poo-pooed and ridiculed. I didn't see much there. But my confidence in my own belief in that was clearly insufficient, because if I had invested my own money along with what I believed to have been successful, I wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation with you, bro.
Well, you might be.
I would be somewhere in a quiet volcano with no bandwidth in my lair. Or in the passenger seat of Elon Musk recently dispatched Tesla. So no, I don't think so. I mean, there's been lots of things that I thought could have happened that didn't happen. So, for example, I always remember when Jeff Zucker, then at NBC, made his speech in which he referred to our massive ability to convert analog dollars to digital dimes, or our failure to convert digital dimes to analog dollars, and always thought that there was an arbitrage marketplace between digital media and analog media. And I was always curious to understand how much you could do in, for example, promoting tune into television programs that in analog media at the price of dimes that converted into GRPs on television that could be sold for high premium dollars. And I'm not sure the degree to which that was lent into. And I wonder if Yahoo's fate had been different if Yahoo had decided we're going to become the best friend of the television industry, for example. And I think, interestingly and asymmetrically, it has now come to pass. And it's come to pass, but in an unexpected way. So if you go and talk to some publishers, they will tell you that, on the one hand, Facebook is the spawn of the devil in terms of what it's done to their monetization of their eyeballs. And they will then, in the next breath or the next sentence, say, but we have never found a more efficient mechanism of driving subscriptions to our property than Facebook. And so perhaps the thing that I always believed in has finally come true, in that effectively arbitraging Facebook inventory into subscriptions is kind of interesting. And what's fascinating about those is that the ARPU of some of those subscriber media, the average revenue per user, is pretty phenomenal. And there are some, the FT probably at the top of this tree, that have got an ARPU pushing towards $500 a year for user. That if you have 1 million subscribers at an ARPU of $500 a year, that's a pretty good number. And I think it's kind of interesting to think about how you drive subscriptions through a lifetime customer value calculus when you have potential value like that.
I mean, do you think it's another very good point there, actually. I mean, do you think that looking at, I don't want to pick any particular publisher, but, you know, newspaper publishers around the world, do you think that this is, they sort of really get this new sort of new commercial models that are available to them through a relationship with somebody like Facebook? Or do you think they're just a sort of rather, they sort of see things rather through a sort of old lens, and therefore what they see is the spawn of the devil point rather than the major business opportunity point?
So I had a thesis a long time ago, Brian, that the subscription business online would be, I described it as a tits and tickers model. Mm-hmm. And the principle of the tits and tickers model was that you were more likely to be a subscriber to sensitive financial information on the one hand, or porn on the other, would be the two things that people were most likely to pay for. I was right about the financial side of it. And as it turns out, not right, particularly about the other side of it. And I think the dilemma is that there are, everyone knows that the place not to be these days is in the middle. Mm. And so if you're extraordinary specialist and specific, the chance of having a really, really successful subscription model, because you've got differentiated content, are really high. If you're not incredibly differentiated by some niche of the content, you have to be incredibly differentiated by the quality of the content and the trust with which it's delivered. So I think the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times have been successful, and the Economist and a few others have been successful for those reasons. But I think for those very same reasons, it's been very difficult for people like the Mail Online or what we used to call Express Newspapers to build subscription businesses, because there's just plain vanilla there and nothing that is exclusively different about that content. And what's fascinating is that when you and I started in the business and we talked about quality, and people debate what does quality mean and have debated it ever since. What does quality mean? I think it's pretty damn obvious what quality means now, and it is, will the customer be prepared to engage in a direct paid relationship with you? And so quality defined by the Financial Times, quality defined by HBO, quality defined by the Premier League, quality defined by anything, it's all clear. It's all clear. If the customer is prepared to pay, you have a quality.
And I mean, if you're just delivering a kind of vanilla offering in the middle, then there's so many places to go to get the vanilla that you don't have to, well, you don't have to be a genius to work out that you're not going to make any money out of it.
Well, which is why there's not a huge subscription business for the rest of soccer outside of the Premier League in Britain, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, of course, could be really fascinating is if the NFL in the US ends up after its next round of rights negotiations going down the same path as the Premier League has in Britain.
That
would be a dark day for advertisers.
It certainly would. So what do you think, I mean, from your sort of position now, where you've exited, as it were, corporate life, although you're obviously doing many, many, many things, what do you see as the next sort of big things that are coming along into which you're going to put your own money and retire to that volcano?
Well, so I think that there's a number of things that are important. I think GDPR compliant data and its application are important because people need quality data for targeting and segmentation. So I'm interested in that. I do believe that engagement and user retention has a business value, even though it may not have binary relationships with business outcomes always, because I don't believe that all good business outcomes are ones that happen within 5 seconds of the contact with the user. So I'm interested in people that do that. I'm interested in people that can solve the manufacturing conundrum of content, which is often either too expensive or too poor, and people that can thread the needle of producing content that's of value to the consumer and the advertiser, but a fraction of the cost of many commercial or TV kind of content. I'm interested in that because I think that will have a value to advertisers. And I'm interested in people who can find sophisticated ways of doing allocation and planning and sophisticated ways of doing attribution. So all of these things are connected to the distribution and measurement of communication for brands, which are the things I've always been interested in. And I suppose the reason why I'm professionally interested in them, Brian, is I don't really know much about anything else. And so, you know, clean coal is not a strong suit for me.
No, I mean, and I guess maybe we could end with some last thoughts on how you see agencies evolving. I think what you've just described as the future, and, you know, in old-fashioned language, we're talking kind of probably planning-related things as opposed to trading-related things, I suppose. But how do you see agencies evolving in this time of immense change?
Well, I think there's a few things. I mean, you know, there's a number of us that have been on different sides of the debate on the trading issue. And I do fundamentally believe that one of the responsibilities of an agency is to transfer value from the seller's side of the table to the buyer's side or the advertiser's side of the table. So I think the ability to negotiate, I think the ability to use insight to find imperfections in marketplaces and identify pockets of value in marketplaces that might not be immediately obvious is something that agencies with a broad and deep view of the world are good at, will be good at, and it's not in the interest of advertisers to diminish agencies' ability to do that. How they get paid for it is a whole another issue, and whether or not it should be disclosed or not disclosed or whatever it might be is a whole other thing, but we don't need to go there. I think that it will survive and it will be important. I think that agencies increasingly will have to understand that they are part of a value chain that provisions clients with their own technology stacks. And I think there are clients, some of them will go to the extreme and own and operate media and ad tech stacks. There are many others that will own the contracts for those stacks and have them operated by agencies. And I think that they will be well served not to try and disintermediate the agencies in those areas, because you don't have to look back very far and say to anyone, well, if you had chosen an ad server or a DSP or a DMP 5 years ago, what are the odds of it still being the right thing now? And what are the odds of you still having an expert cohort of people inside your enterprise to operate it on? And I think agencies are an incredibly helpful resource in that area. And I do worry that there has been not so much in the UK, although partially in the UK, but I think the degree of, and you know, and I have many friends who work for the companies, I think there's been a degree of hostility and hyperbole in the US on this subject, which overplays whatever wrongdoing there may or may not have been, given the relative lack of smoking guns that have emerged since the ANA report. Mm. And my own sense is that the agency ecosystem is now and has been very important to clients. And I think that what both parties could do to be of great help to one another is to think about how they look at automating resources, but to create new incentives to do that. Because if the incentive to automate in an agency is merely to lose the man hours that you're currently paid for in a transparent environment, it's a kind of difficult calculus. And for clients and agencies who are very sophisticated enterprises, both on both sides, to work through together what the new model of the agency-client relationship with and what the rewards for efficiency should be and what the rewards for effectiveness should be, I think is a much better future than one that is based on a very old model of commission or allegedly a newer transparent model of man hours and nothing else. And I think that there's too many blunt instruments at play.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I think that's a good point to stop, because I think we can all agree with that. I think that's an excellent thought. And I think we're kind of entering a kind of era of collaboration and cooperation between people with expertise on all sides, frankly. And I think, you know, agencies have got great expertise.
I'd like to say one more thing, Brian. You know, people talk a lot, as one of the kind of headline things about this, is they talk about the ad tech tax, and they talk about, you know, there's lots of people have to, you know, for every $100 that starts here, only $50 ends there. And it's always perceived as a bad thing. There's a different way of looking at it completely. If people bake all of these things into the CPM, cost per thousand that's payable for the media, then that's what happens. But one of the reasons why people bake them into CPMs is because the advertiser, and sometimes the agency, is very concerned between the distinction of working media and non-working media, which in a day of data provisioning and technology provisioning seems to me somewhat redundant. And if they thought instead of underlying media costs and then built SaaS contracts, software as a service contracts, on top of those media costs, then people wouldn't be talking about this as an ad tech tax in the same way, and certainly wouldn't be talking about it in the demonic way that they talk about it.
Again, okay, a very good point on which to end. So, Rob, thanks a lot for your time, and all the very best in your new advisory roles, as it were.
Thank you. I'm buying a lot of slippers.